You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of our best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So in today's episode, I'd like to do a follow-up story I did a few weeks ago on Lily Phillips. And she was the woman who had basically engaged in a stunt where she slept with 100 men in the course of 24 hours. So after she did that video or that like stunt, she said that her next challenge, quote unquote, was going to be sleeping with 1,000 men over the course of 24 hours. Now, I'm sure much to her fury and surprise, another woman called Bonnie Blue, whose real name is Tia Billinger, has bet her to the punch. I wanted to cover the story, and it's probably going to be the last story of this nature I cover for a while, because I think it has a lot to say about my own perception of like what I perceive the motivations for doing certain things are, and what I sometimes think we all can fall prey to or victim to. And that is the idea that when women do like self-destructive actions or bad actions or immoral actions, like sometimes there's almost too much of a rush to try and explain their behavior or their choices in a way that doesn't cast them as victims or helpless sort of people who've fallen into the web or prey of somebody else. And I would say with the Lily Phillips story, I definitely wanted to cover that angle because that is also a legitimate angle to cover. But, you know, when I sat back and I looked at some of like the media posts that she's made, when I listened to some of the interviews, I'd actually already listened to a couple of interviews she had done when I did the research for the Lily Phillips episode. But one thing that did occur to me, and especially when I looked at some of the analysis that other women did, like, I think sometimes we give people, specifically women, too much of a pass. Like, sometimes we're too quick to focus on the victim narrative that we ignore the other side of the story, that people, women included specifically in this episode, can and do make choices that are not good choices. And they're making those choices not because somebody has a gun to their head, not because they don't know any better, not just because they come from like troubled past, quote unquote. Sometimes they do it because it brings them notoriety, it gives them infamy, it gives them fame, it gives them money, it gives them their version of success. And all those individual motivating factors are as legitimate as the victim narrative. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later in the episode. But before I even launch into that, in case you don't know who Bonnie Blue is, she's a UK-born woman. She's about 25 years old. What we know about her personal life before she sort of was launched onto the public scene with like various stunts was that she was married for a while. So she's with her childhood sweetheart. They've been together since she was 13. They broke up when she was like 23, 24. Allegedly, he still works for her behind the scenes. She herself and he also came from a well-to-do middle-class family, him in particular. He went to a private school where the annual tuition is like £45,000 a year, which I think is maybe like $60,000. I'd have to do the exchange, but something around that figure. So, you know, she didn't come from a poor background, put it that way. She came from, at the minimum, a middle income, even higher end of middle income background. And her husband obviously also came from the same home. We know that around 2022, she ends up separating with her husband, although they're not legally divorced yet. And before actually even she separated from him, they had already moved to Australia and she'd already started like doing cam girl stuff. You know, like when you put like a video cam, you talk to men and they buy credits to speak to you and sometimes send you money for other things or for special requests. So we know that she was already doing that in 2022 and she was doing that with the support of her husband. They both were making a pretty decent chunk of money off of that in the early years. They were making something like £5,000 a week, which is, you know, £20,000 a month is like amazing money. And then she didn't really blow up until she started doing like more, I would say like sensationalist, like rage baity sort of content. Specifically, like the first time I came across her in a meaningful sense was when she was going around university campuses and she was basically recruiting volunteers who were like young men, like 18, 19, 20, 21. And she was recruiting them to have sex with her on videos that were focused on titles related to like barely legal. So her angle was sleeping with barely legal or young teenage men or young adult men. And that was the reason why she even grabbed attention in the first place, because a lot of people were basically looking at her and trying to understand what her motivation was. And then also you could see from like the interviews that she did during that time, you could see that people really struggled to identify what she was doing as like predatory. Like a lot of the comments were very conflicted. A lot of the interview questions were very conflicted, because so often the narrative of women when they are engaged in sex work, and specifically this sort of digital based, OnlyFans based, like stunty, rage baity content, like we struggle to see them outside the narrative of victim. And that's exactly what you saw when you saw like various media outlets interviewing her. So that's a quick background on her. In terms of like her professional career as an adult entertainer and OnlyFans content creator, I think one of the things that I noticed when I look at her interviews and how she comes across and the things that she speaks about, when you look at the videos and the captions that accompany her videos, and you look at some of the sound bites that she releases on TikTok or Instagram or YouTube, you can see that she is a woman who understands her USP very well, and she understands like rage bait content creation very, very well. So when you go back to like one of the first like stunts that she had, where she went around Nottingham Trent University around Freshers Week, and she basically had posters inviting like, you know, freshers, like first year university students, to have sex with her on video. And she not only had that poster and had herself recorded next to that poster and had herself interacting with students and captured their shock and intrigue, she also clearly was trying to enrage the parents of the children who had been sent to university who were interacting with this porn star or with this content creator. And really, you can tell that the people who are mostly like really enraged are women. And to be honest, it's not that surprising. Like the women are the ones who are calling her a predator, mostly who are saying that she's preying on young men who don't understand the choice before them. And she's luring them into making a decision that is going to impact their psychology and their psyche, that it might impact their future life choices. So like that's the narrative mostly coming from women. In terms of men though, like the men, I feel like their empathy levels are lower than they should be. And to be honest, like this is not even that surprising. Even when we hear of like famous cases where a woman has been exposed for having a sexual relationship with like a teenager who is her student or a teenager who is in her care in some other way, most of the time it's the women who are calling for justice to be served. What we hear often from men in these types of stories is usually like an attaboy attitude, especially if the woman is hot or is attractive or conventionally good looking. In that case, then the story is even worse from the perspective of look, what you'd expect to hear from adults who should care about the welfare of their young girls as much as they care about the welfare of like their young boys. If she's a good-looking woman, like most of the time, honestly, there is no empathy to be had from the perspective of men. They essentially see the boys as having won because they got, quote-unquote, an opportunity to have sex with a woman. And I think maybe the reason they might feel like that is because the nature of sexual exploitation by a woman against a boy is going to be different than by a man against a woman or a boy, just because of the physical dynamics, if you use your imagination. But even outside of that, because we assume there's not going to be violence, often it's through like psychological manipulation, and it's through like grooming, and it's through like giving them like the care they might not be receiving elsewhere in their lives, as opposed to like, you know, forcefulness, I guess you could say. Maybe that's why they don't have as much empathy. But I also generally think a lot of the reason why they don't have empathy for the boys, like the men I'm speaking about here, is because they fail to see like victimhood in men in general. And I think that's because they see victimhood expressed in a man as being fundamentally weak and as being something that takes away from a man, like makes him less of a man. And so I think if they fail to see victimhood in men in general, then when they're looking at boys who will become men one day, I think their empathy is that is diminished as well. So they don't see that the power imbalance between like a 15-year-old boy and like a 30-year-old woman is going to be extremely high. Like the imbalance is going to be extremely high. They also don't see that the boy is unable to consent, because if you go back to my episode around why I think age gap relationships between certain ages are inherently predatory, is because the younger person's frontal cortex literally has not developed yet. They don't even have the capacity to make long-term plans and to understand the consequences in the future of their actions. And so when you take a 15-year-old boy and you put him in a sexual relationship with a 30-year-old woman who's supposed to be looking after him in some way, maybe she's his teacher or his caretaker in another way, of course that is always going to be inherently predatory. And I don't think that from men's perspective, but also from women, I just don't think we see that victimhood or that victimness in boys in the same way. It also even makes me think about the relationship between the president of France, Emmanuel Macron, and his wife, Brigitte. And literally, like, she was a predator. Like, that's exactly how their relationship started. It started when she was like 39, 40 years old, and he was one of her students. He was like 15 years old when they initially met, and she was 39, actually. And we don't know exactly what the timeline is, but we know that very early on, probably when he was like 16, they started a sexual relationship, and their Emmanuel Macron's family ended up finding out about the relationship, and they ended up like taking him out of that school and shipping him away to a different school, like away from her. And after he graduated from high school, he found his way back to her, and they've been together ever since. Now, I think sometimes when relationships that start out as seedy and sinister, like endure the test of time, like that endurance over the test of time can sometimes like sanitize it. So put another way, because they've been together for so long, it's almost as though we don't look at their relationship with like raised eyebrows, but we really should. Because ultimately, like a 39-year-old woman who at the time was married, so she was cheating on her husband, and she already had like two children, so she was betraying her children and her family anyway. She was his teacher, which means she was betraying her office and her oath to look after children. And she was also his teacher, therefore that power imbalance was there. She was also his teacher who was more than double his age. She was 39 when he was 15, which means that the level of comprehension and understanding about the consequences of their actions are going to be understood radically different from the perspective of a 15, 16-year-old and a 39/40-year-old. So that relationship, like, honestly, she should have gone to prison. Actually, let me just double check what the age of consent is. Okay, the age of consent is 15 in France. So she wouldn't have gone to prison anyway if they had discovered their relationship. But just because somebody literally just turned 15 or is like literally barely legal doesn't make the relationship less predatory. It's still predatory for all the other reasons that I've given, like the age difference, her being his teacher, her occupying a position of power, her having like much more intellectual capacity at 39 than a 15-year-old would, her brain having been fully formed and being able to comprehend the consequences and risks involved in her actions, all things that would have been inaccessible at 15 to Emmanuel Macron. So it's sort of like, you know, that is an example of sort of the sanitization of predatory relationship when the predatoriness is expressed by the woman or it's the woman who is the predator. But honestly, it doesn't make it any less predatory. And so when we go back to the Bonnie Blue story, like if you imagine like a 25-year-old man going onto university campuses and inviting like 18, 19, 20-year-old women to come and have sex with him on camera, like on film, Like, we would say that that is a predator, because he's literally going to places where kids are supposed to be gathering for education, and he's preying on the fact that they don't understand, like, the consequences of what he is propositioning. And the fact that he would even go to a place of learning where young people congregate to and go there specifically to hopefully make their lives better for themselves and to give themselves more opportunities. The fact that that man would even go to that place with that intention in itself would tell us that he is somebody who is sinister. And so, like, the rationale and the analysis still holds when you replace that man with Bonnie Blue. Her going to that institution or to universities in general, especially at an exciting, fun time like Freshers Week, and propositioning boys who are in our culture incentivized and almost like socialized to sort of like grow up sexually before they are ready. You know, like, for example, porn is pushed down their throat, like they're hypersexualized from a very early age. Their value is connected socially to how many girls and women they can basically sleep with. So they're already in a position where they're hypersexualized and forced to grow up sexually quicker than they are probably psychologically and physically ready for. So for her to go into that environment where young men and young boys congregate and sort of try and superimpose herself and sort of diminish from what Freshers Week should be, and on top of that, like tempting them with this thing, i.e. sex, which a lot of boys feel like their key to manhood is by having sex, and here is a woman, an attractive woman, offering free sex to them. Of course that is going to be very alluring to young boys for all those reasons. And because her maturity allows her to understand this in a way that their own immaturity doesn't allow them to, it makes her actions inherently predatory. Like, the where she goes to lure people or to recruit people, and then on top of that, the motivations for going to those places, and then if you consider her target audience or target, like, people she's trying to recruit, all those things are inherently sinister at the very least. And to be honest, I think as well what's happening when she, like, recruits young people, like young men who are naive and don't fully comprehend, like, what is at stake, she's also forcing them to make a choice to be a certain kind of man before they fully understand that that's what's going on. Because no matter how you slice and dice it, like, men who would intentionally, knowingly participate in the sexual exploitation of a woman are a specific kind of man. Like, in my eyes, they're not a good man. Like, they're not somebody with virtue. They're not somebody with honor. They're not somebody who is a good and kind. They're sexual predators themselves. Like, even, like, everyday Johns who, like, drive up and down the street trying to find, like, sex workers. I mean, I imagine that's how, like, it works, but maybe there's, like, designated places where they go and they know that that's where the women are going to be. But even, like, everyday Johns, in my view, are predators, because they know that the women are on the streets not because they love sex and because they want to be there. They know that those women are there out of financial necessity because they need to make a living for themselves. I mean, there's other factors around, like, sexual abuse as minors and things that drive women into even considering that a possibility. That's an episode for another day. But even at a surface level, those Johns, like those men who pay for sex with women on the street who they know are economically coerced to being there, are not good people. So that character also applies to men who would have sex, especially when the woman is having, like, at the university thing, the university stunt, Bonnie Blue had sex with 158 men. So the kind of man who would have sex, the woman who has signed up, quote unquote, to have sex with 158 men is not a good man, because basic reasoning would tell you that that is not a choice that somebody who is mentally well, emotionally healthy, that's not the kind of choice that that person makes. And so if that woman is making that choice to exploit herself sexually and you are participating in her sexual exploitation, guess what that makes you? That makes you a bad person as well. I don't think that 18-year-olds understand that. I don't think like 19, 20-year-olds understand the moral implications of being a participator even if they're a willing participator, they don't understand what is actually at stake here. Like, your actions define who you are and define who your character is. And the problem is that when you haven't yet fully mentally developed and gain some wisdom that can come from literally just the passage of time and having your brain being fully formed and being exposed to like thoughts that challenge like that kind of thinking, when you haven't had that opportunity to grow in that way and to develop mentally in that way and to develop intellectually and emotionally in that way, you're going to make choices that trap you into being a kind of person that you perhaps, if you had known, wouldn't have been. It kind of reminds me of when I did the Lily Phillips episode, and when I watched the documentary that guy Josh made, where it's entitled like I Loved It, something like that. Like, I remember one of the young men that came out after having sex with Lily Phillips, and his hand was shaking. Like, he was shaken by the experience. He tried to take a drink of like Lucozade or some other orange drink, and his hand was shaking so uncontrollably that he literally like couldn't get the drink in his mouth. And when the interviewer asked him like why was he so shaken by the experience, you could tell that he hadn't anticipated the emotional and psychological toll that engaging in that kind of sex in that kind of way would, like, he hadn't anticipated that it would feel like that for him, that it would feel bad for him, that it would impact him psychologically. And immediately he expressed feelings of shame and regret, and he expressed fear, and he said something like, my parents would kill me if they ever found out I did something like that. You know, so I honestly think like these boys interacting with Bonnie Blue in this way literally are naive young people who don't understand the true choices of what they're making, which is why I think like her actions, her specifically targeting like 20, 21 year olds, 19 year olds, 18 year olds is inherently predatory. They don't understand what they're signing up for. I also think like not taking Bonnie Blue's actions like through the lens that she's telling us, she's telling us, nobody's making me do this, I like doing this, I enjoy doing this. Like, if we don't see it through her perspective, then we kind of underappreciate how clever she's been about like her whole strategy. Because this is a woman, at the end of the day, no matter what you say about her, she's a woman who has to date been making somewhere between $600,000 and $750,000like a month, like on a monthly basis, which, by the way, the tax bill for that must be crazy. So if she's been able to make that much money and has sustained it for a considerable amount of time now, like, it's kind of almost unfair or diminishing to her intellect and her strategy and her intentionality to cast her as a victim, because it kind of implies that she's not making knowing choices, that she's not making strategic choices, that she has experienced this success haphazardly. And I don't think that's the case. I think she's been really clever about how she positions herself in an overly subscribed market, I would say, which OnlyFans is, if you listen to my Lily Phillips episode. Like, the average person makes like £1,000 or $1,000 a month. Not even that. Like, the top 20% earners earn as much as the bottom 80%. So it's a highly hierarchical, overly subscribed market where for you to make money, you have to be very clever with your marketing. And so her focusing on the barely legal category, I feel like, is a stroke of evil genius, because we already know that the most highly searched term on porn sites, and I think specifically the research they did was on Pornhub, was barely legal, or it was like teenage focused content. So her making her strategy or her focus teenagers and barely legal young people means that automatically in any platform where sexual content is like viewed and purchased, she's going to go high up in the search rank anyway, because that's already a category that men really look for. And it isn't just straight men, by the way, it's also gay men. So it's already a category that is highly fetishized and is highly sought after, which means that automatically she hasn't chosen like an obscure or niche or narrow market to position herself in. She's chosen like the most successful market to be in. She also has been very clever in engaging both men and women to amplify her voice on the national stage. Like, if she had just been quietly making pornography that was focused on, like, just everyday men without, like, an age component, I don't think we'd be hearing about her, because there are many OnlyFans, OnlyFans creators and OnlyFans stars and adult entertainers and pornographers who already make content that is directed towards the male gaze, who have sex with men of all ages. That is not special. That is not unique. That has no shock factor anymore in our society. What does have shock factor, however, is a woman who is behaving as predatory as a man can behave. So she is causing shock, not because she is having sex, because we see that all the time. She's shocking because she is gleeful in her predatoriness. She's gleeful, and she has clever retorts when people challenge her on her targeting, like, 18, 19, 20 year old boys to have sex with on film. So in terms of, like, rage bait content, she's managed to cater to the male gaze, focus and target young men who are then going to be, like, long-term consumers, especially if you get them hooked very early on. She also is making it into, like, doing the rounds in terms of, like, media outlets, because women are so enraged, and women are big consumers of, like, talk show content, for example, and podcast content. And so she's going to have them listening to her again, and their rage and their fury and their, like, disgust with her basically, like, garners her more views. So she's getting the male attention, she's getting the female attention, and the shock factor basically keeps her in the headlines. And the focus on the barely legal, like, sexually exploitative content of, like, young men makes sure that she stands out on a platform that is very difficult to stand out on now. So again, like, if we only focus on the fact, quote unquote, that she might be a victim, that she might come from a difficult background, that she, you know, for example, like, we know she didn't know her biological father. We also know that her mom works for her behind the scenes, which is, like, a red flag. We can form and craft a story that is focused on her victimhood. But again, I feel like that is an interpretation of the female experience that robs us of being able to see people, specifically women, in the full complexities of who they are. Because it's not like women have a narrow range of emotions. Like I said at the top of the episode, they have all kinds of different motivating factors for doing things. And it isn't only because it's coming from a sad place or a sunken place or like a disenfranchised and disempowered place. They can also do things that they have strategically thought through and recognize that it's going to bring them benefit, and they can do it from a place where they feel empowered by it. And so really for me, like, my takeaways from this whole debacle is, like, the first thing I thought was it must be really difficult to make money on OnlyFans. I mean, I already knew that because I did that episode on Lily Phillips, and I specifically focused on the dynamics of making money on the platform and how the machine or the platform makes the biggest chunk, how there's only a few stars that make disproportionately more money than everybody else, and how the average person makes less than, like, even minimum wage, and that, like, 80% of people make not enough money to survive. And so I already knew it was, like, a tough market to be in anyway, but the fact that people now have to resort to extreme stunts like this, like having to have sex with 100 men, as in the Lily Phillips case, or having to have sex with 1,000 people, as is the case for Bonnie Blue, it tells me it's a tough market to be in, because there was a time when people did significantly less and they still made, like, decent money. They still made money. So, like, back in the day, for example, when you think about, I don't know, even think about, like, the early days of, like, OnlyFans, like, honestly, like, people at first could make money by, like, posting pictures of themselves implying nudity. And then they had to, like, show a little bit of nudity. And then they did show full nudity. And then they could engage in, like, soft porn content. But now, like, they have to do like, if you are an OnlyFans creator entering the market now, and you know that, like, in recent months, like, some of the highest earning OnlyFans content creators have had to engage in extreme acts like this of having sex with 100,000 people, for you to, like, beat them, you're gonna have to do something on their level or higher. No, actually, not on their level, because the whole point is you have to beat them you have to do something more extreme than they did. Otherwise, you're not standing out because somebody has already done it. So again, like my first thought was like, that it must be a tough market to make. It must be very difficult to hang on to the limelight, even when you have it. Because, you know, clearly if she could just have sex with like one person and record it and maybe have a little bit of kink play, if she could like still make that much bank, she probably would be doing that because it's less exerting. People try in most circumstances to get the most money for the least effort. And so if she has to make this much effort, it implies that basically it's oversaturated. Like her own market is oversaturated and her own audience requires more to continue to giving her more money. I think another thing that this like this experience or this episode has reminded me of as well is like the nature of like commodification of female sexuality, in that I genuinely feel like it has decreasing returns. Like the more it's given, the less it's desired and the less value is ascribed to it. And you can really kind of see this when you look back at like back in the day to how sexuality was used by Hollywood actresses. So back in Marilyn Monroe's era, for example, there was relatively little nudity in the mainstream, like very, very little nudity. There was even like crimes, like legislation against it. So back in those times, like a little bit of sexuality went a long way, and it was done in kind of discreet ways for the most part. Like sadly, the casting couch was still a big factor of Hollywood. Like a lot of women had to be sexually exploited basically to be given like film opportunities and opportunities to be stars. And outside of that as well, though, the level of like using their sex in terms of what the public could see is very, very minimal. Like when you think of Marilyn Monroe in that white dress and she's standing over like a street vent and her white dress is being blown upwards and it's exposing like her legs and a little bit of her like underwear. Like that was like shocking back in the day. Like that was like sensational because here a woman was and you could see her stockings, you could see her legs, and you could even see like part of her underwear. It was like a massively shocking thing back then, because again, sex in the public sphere in like the mainstream was so minimal that when it was exposed or when it was seen, it was very, very shocking. However, what we see is that as time went by, like that wasn't the case. Like as time went by, we started getting publications like Playboy. And Playboy, by the way, was first, like its first issue, they used, Hugh Hefner used the picture that he had bought of Marilyn Monroe. She basically had to like engage in like nude photography to make a living when she was going through tough times. And Hugh Hefner ended up buying those pictures unbeknownst to Marilyn Monroe. And for the first cover of Playboy, he has a picture of Marilyn Monroe. And she has like darker hair back then because she was sort of like incognito. But he uses that picture of her as the first issue of Playboy. And that was like one of the very first publications that featured like full frontal nudity of women. And as time went by, we know that like the poses were more extreme. Like you could literally see absolutely everything. So we go from a time where a woman standing over a vent and like the vent exposing her legs was like shocking, to a point where we've got magazines in the mainstream that are sold in like supermarkets and newsstands featuring full on frontal nudity and nudity from everywhere being like just like an everyday like thing where you don't even bat an eyelid. And then like time goes on and we have like an explosion of like online pornography. Like back in the day, like people used to actually pay for pornography. Like they would take their credit card and they would buy like DVDs or rent DVDs, or they'd buy movies online. Whereas now like it's exploded so much that it's free. Like the idea of even paying for pornography is like absurd because there's a proliferation of free content online. So again, it's like there's so much of it, but the more of it there is online, the less valuable sex is, the less valuable the women who sell sex and who engage in the manufacturing of pornography are perceived. And so again, it's an example of sort of like more being out there decreases the value of that thing. And so I think all of that is relevant in that it gives context to the Bonnie Blue OnlyFans era that we're in. Because again, in the context of living in a world where online pornography is a thing. It's free, it's accessible. You can get it on your mobile phone. You can get it basically everywhere where you have an internet connection. And 9 times out of 10, or 99.99% of the time, you don't have to pay for it because there's so much of it. How do you make a living as somebody who's like an adult entertainer? How do you make a living when you're a porn star, or you're an OnlyFans creator that creates sexual content? The way you make a living is you have to engage in levels of behaviors and actions and scenes that are way above what is already freely accessible. Otherwise, you're not going to stand out from the crowd. Like, you're not going to stand out from the crowd by just having sex on film. There's literally billions of videos online. You're not going to even stand out because you've had sex with like 2-3 people, or because you've done like kinky actions. You've done like novel things in those videos. Like, those days are long gone. The new era that we're in now, the context that we live in now, is that people who make their money from engaging in sex work have to do increasingly self-destructive, sexually exploitative, rage-baity, click-baity, shocking content. Otherwise, there's no way for them to stand out in the masses and masses and masses of free sexual content out there. And to be honest, even the fact that people are willing to pay like a monthly subscription to subscribe to OnlyFans content in itself is quite a feat. Again, because it's so easily accessible to the average person. Like, if they want to watch like pornography, like even the fact that they're willing to pay like $5.99 or $10.99 in itself is a massive feat. And so I feel like for the OnlyFans who are making money on OnlyFans, again, there are very few of them, for them to like hang on to their subscribers, they have to do these kinds of crazy stunts. I also think, like, ironically, what is going to happen, and to some extent the Bonnie Blue thing kind of shows us that that is already happening, is women are going to return to traditional forms of sex work. They're essentially using OnlyFans as a marketing tool, but then for them to make the same amount of money or a decent amount of money, they still have to have sex with them in person. Because part of the OnlyFans appeal, especially for the people who were like preaching OnlyFans before, they're basically saying like this is a much safer form of sex work because they never have to meet their Johns. Instead of having to meet up in a street corner or a car or like a rented apartment and have sex with people who could kill you with their bare hands, you now just chat to them online. You send them like personalized sexual pictures. You send them personalized sexual videos. But crucially, you never have to put your physical safety at risk. But really what we're seeing is that that's not going to cut it anymore. Like, that's not going to cut it in the context of, sure, personalization is nice, but they ultimately like care about the sex more than they care about the personalization. And given that they can get free videos online, they can even get like one-off cam girls to like do what they want and record those people. I genuinely think we're going to increasingly see that OnlyFans is basically like a platform where people agree to meet up to have sex in these sort of like shocking ways, you know? So instead of like putting your advert in like a newspaper, you know, under like those old singles adverts where it'd be like a like single 30-year-old woman seeking for companionship and good times. Like, instead of posting like an advert, a discreet advert in a paper, it's basically like you're showing what you can do on OnlyFans, and then you're meeting up with like your clients to have sex with them in person. So ironically, it's just reverting back to like traditional forms of sex work, which is highly dangerous to women. Thank God that somebody like Bonnie Blue has made so much money off of OnlyFans that she can afford to hire security. So her and Lily Phillips, when they conducted their stunts, they had heavy security. Bonnie Blue went to even more extreme lengths where she hired multiple locations, and the multiple locations each served different functions. So like one building was for like screening them, essentially to see if they're like under the influence, if they've been drinking, they breathalyze them. The other building was to like check their IDs and their passports and their medical certificates and all that kind of stuff. And then the final place was where Bonnie actually was, where they would have sex. So she can afford to do those things. And she also had like heavy security, people to accompany them from location to location, people to screen them, people at the doors, multiple people inside the property making sure that the men stayed in line. And so it was a highly regulated, highly sanitized and safe environment from the perspective of nobody was going to kill her because there was so much like security in place. But for the average sex worker online on OnlyFans who doesn't even make $1,000 a month, who clearly knows that she needs to like bolster her income by having sex with these men, which is what these men want, by the way, ultimately, she's not gonna be able to afford that security. So I do think it's like a pipeline into just having traditional forms of sex work or engaging in traditional forms of sex work that puts the women in as much risk as they ever were in before. Another thing that I had to confront with this story, and maybe even for my own feelings, is that sometimes we think that when people do immoral things or bad things, I feel like we secretly hope and think that karma is going to get them. Like, sure, you're making £650,000 a month and £750,000 a month, and you have these fabulous experiences, you can live in like these glamorous places, but eventually bad things happen to people who do bad things, or to girls who don't behave, to women who don't behave. And so we're kind of like standing on the sideline, like, you know, enjoy the success while you can, because, you know, that's going to be taken away from you soon. But ultimately, you know, I just think this is something we tell ourselves to make ourselves feel better about ourselves, because we have plenty of real life experiences where we know that that's not true. Like, there are plenty of people who do immoral things, shall we say, and karma doesn't come and get them. In fact, like, they are thriving. If you consider, for example, like, even, maybe this is like controversial, but even in the Me Too movement, obviously there were many, many legitimate victims who, thanks to the Me Too movement and thanks to the like wide media coverage of the Me Too movement, we really saw behind the curtains and we saw like to what extent like these predators, like male predators, like really prey on young women, young actresses like entering the field, and saw how protected they were. Like, in many ways, like, we saw, like, one of the things that I remember about the Me Too movement era, when like when it was like just everywhere, was the silence from the men. Like, the silence from the men to me spoke as much volume as the women who were like exposing these predators. But another thing that I also will never forget, and, you know, I don't tend to say this in public, but one of the things I also remember thinking was how many women were happy to engage in that trade-off, engage in selling their bodies or giving their bodies in exchange for commercial success. And I put this in the context of, like, nobody needs to be like a millionaire. Like, I make a distinction between people who like literally have no choices and have no alternatives, and therefore they need to engage in behaviors, or they engage in behaviors that cause them harm, but they ultimately feel like they have no choices. For this, I kind of feel like you don't need to be awarded like a $350,000 or like $500,000 contract. Get me? So when the Me Too movement was going on, I was like, okay, on the one hand, I get, and I'm interested in the stories of women telling the stories of their exploitation. However, I also noticed and clocked how many women were happy to never reveal their stories, because to some extent they must have considered that trade-off as being worthwhile for them, especially in the context of they aren't on the breadlines. They aren't like a single mother trying to feed their children who's been abandoned by her partner and she has no other alternatives but to like engage in sex work or trade her body for money. Like, no, like, they are would have done okay anyway. They could have gotten a regular job. Many of these women didn't even come from like necessarily like poor backgrounds. Like, I won't even name who they are because I think that's not necessary. But I remember thinking like, people clearly are willing to do all kinds of things for fame. And I don't agree that we should cast all those women as victims, because many, many of them were victims. But many of them made a calculated risk and a calculated decision and thought that they are willing to sleep with men in order for them to have the kind of financial success that they envision for themselves. And to be honest, like, I would kind of put Bonnie Blue in this category in a way, because the only difference is that it's happening in front of us as opposed to like happening behind closed doors. And then obviously it's like an extreme, a much more extreme form. Like, most people who sleep their way to the top or who engage in trading like sex for play don't have to engage in this level of sexual exploitation, I'd imagine. However, they are calculating how much money they can make and thinking that instead of working in recruitment like Bonnie Blue did, or instead of working a 9-to-5 job, or instead of working like a job at McDonald's, they're like, no, I can really make a lot of money if I do this thing, or if I do these things with these people. And I honestly, like, sometimes when I see like an actor or an actress who is like mediocre at best or not good, like, one of the things I think is, I wonder how they got to their position, because clearly it isn't through skill, especially when they're not like phenomenally good looking. And when I read Rose McGowan's story around her victimization by Harvey Weinstein, she named like a few women in the book who have never like spoken out about Harvey Weinstein, who maintain a relationship maintained a relationship with Harvey Weinstein's production company for like their entire careers. Sometimes when I see those types of women in the media and I consider how unqualified they are to have the level of commercial success as actors that they enjoy, I think like, like, obviously, clearly there's another thing that explains why they have gotten to the top. The only difference is that these things are behind closed doors and the public doesn't know what they've done to like be awarded those contracts or who they've engaged sexually with to be awarded those contracts. But in terms of like karma getting people who take the easy route, quote unquote, or who use their body sexually to get what they want, like, it's not coming for them. Like, many people who've gone that route are successful and thriving. And so sometimes I feel like when the public is like kind of wagging their finger and they're kind of like counting down the days until people like Lily Phillips or Bonnie Blue or even Kim Kardashian like get taken down by karma, I genuinely think they're going to be waiting a very, very long time, because the world under which we live literally does reward people for engaging in that kind of activity. And this is the final point I'll make as well. I think in particular, we all struggle to see women like through that lens of like villainy, or through that lens of making calculated decisions to ensure their own success. And honestly, not just like that we fail to see that they can and do these things, I think sometimes we also can't even imagine that women can be as clever, as villainously clever as they actually are, and that they can weaponize our own perceptions of what the female experience and what we believe about women. We don't see that they use that against us. One of the things that sometimes lives rent-free in my mind is how Kim Kardashian has been able to spawn like a billion-dollar franchise through her exploitation initially of what we believe like about women. So when her sex tape comes out, she pretends as though it's been leaked against her will, that she didn't know this tape was out there, that somebody's coming to get her. You see her on her show Keeping Up with the Kardashians, which is when I started watching it back in the day after the tape was released. Because the tape comes out pretty much around the same time that she gets her own show, which in itself is suspect. Then she has like this first season or first couple of season where they're focusing on this storyline of her in tears and being like traumatized with the fact that these people are trying to financially exploit her by leveraging this tape they have on her. Fine. We swallow that like hook, line, and sinker. Only to find out like years and years later that she recorded the tape on purpose. She released the tape, like she financially benefited from the tape. And we know that not from speculation only, because we already had been speculating before, but we have confirmation from one of the participants in the tape, Ray J, who said that they made the tape knowingly. And the only reason he even came out in the end is because Kim Kardashian's family tried to paint him as like this predatory black man who had exploited Kim Kardashian, and that he might have been behind the leak. And Ray J, with his daughters and not wanting to be perceived in that way by his family or the public, had to come out and say, like, why are you trying to weaponize the public against me and play into like negative stereotypes of what racist America believes about black men, to paint me out as somebody who would sexually exploit you and that might have colluded with other people to sell this tape. He comes out and says, we made the tape together, one. We recorded multiple iterations of the tape. We changed outfits. And your mother ended up deciding the final cut that we were going to sell to this, to the media company that ended up buying the tape. And he ends up showing the signature where he signed on the dotted line for the release of the tape and for the agreement, I guess, for the amount of money that they both would be paid for that tape. And honestly, when you look back now, it's pretty obvious. It's obvious also because like a sex tape had basically launched Paris Hilton's career. I mean, I will say in Paris Hilton's case, I don't believe that she released her own tape. I do think that was like revenge porn by her ex-boyfriend. But certainly what Kim Kardashian from the sidelines saw was that it literally made her an overnight sensation and went and took her from being like a kind of known like socialite who they know the Hiltons because the Hiltons owned hotels anyway, to being like the star that she eventually became. Like clearly Kim Kardashian was observing and decided that she wanted a slice of that success. So going back to the kinds of myths that we believe about women, I think when we believe that women can only engage in sex or sexually exploitative content as victims and not as directors of their own like fates, I think it kind of like blinds us to the fact that these kinds of things go on. And even if we're just talking about not somebody like Kim Kardashian, but talking about somebody like Bonnie Blue as we are here, I genuinely think like always directing like the focus to like their backgrounds, to what might have happened in their upbringings, to what their mothers and fathers might have done that caused them to be this kind of person, when we focus on the circumstances of their childhood and their socioeconomic factors, I think sometimes we could do that to the detriment of honoring the full story and honoring the full complexities of human beings, in this case women, in that they are capable of doing things that are bad or immoral. They are capable of doing things that might seem on the surface to us like destructive to them psychologically, emotionally, physically, but that they are doing it on purpose. They're doing it because they know they're going to benefit from it in the long term. And also when we always focus on like the victim narrative, we can also like not see the fact that women also do evil, bad things. In Bonnie Blue's case, the evil thing to me clearly is not that she's a sex worker or produces pornography, like whatever, like people do things for all kinds of reasons and I'm not necessarily against it, like point blank period. But I do think specifically the part where she targets like young men, when she targets the barely legal like segment of the population, I think that part is predatory. I also think her like adopting like manosphere lingo where she's basically saying to women like this is what happens when you don't treat your man well, when you don't satisfy them sexually, then I take your place and they come to me because I can do those things. She makes all kinds of derogatory comments towards women that is designed to be rage clicky and rage baity. Like those two components, the manosphere rage bait stuff and then the rage bait connected to like the exploitation of young boys of 18, 19, 20 or 21 year old boys, like that's a specific part where I think is immoral. And I think that we should see her through the lens that we would see any other male predator, because even with male predators who end up being like sexual deviants, who end up like sexually exploiting like boys and girls and women and men, like we can also say that they have mitigating factors, that their backgrounds contributed to them becoming monsters, because most people agree that monsters are created and not born, which means that there are a specific set of circumstances and contexts and situations that contribute to them becoming monsters, that things go wrong in their lives, that they're mistreated or neglected or abused or abandoned, and that causes them to develop atypically and causes them to do evil stuff or bad things or to view women and children in negative and pathological ways. We can literally ascribe those same kinds of mitigating factors to male predators. And the reason we don't do that is because, one, we accept the idea that people can come from all kinds of different backgrounds, difficult backgrounds, and still decide and still choose to be good people and make positive choices. And two, we also accept that even if people have had negative backgrounds or negative experiences, that doesn't absolve them from being accountable for the bad things that they do. So going back to like Bonnie Blue, like I do think it's important to focus on the actions. And sure, there's still room to like investigate other things in her life, like, you know, like understanding from a sociological point of view, from a societal point of view, from like a just being invested in understanding why people come to do bad things. We can still be interested in her background, but I don't think that that should be the dominating narrative, especially in the context of we know she came from a good background. Like a two-parent home, sure, one of them was a stepfather, but it was still a two-parent home. She came from a middle-class family. You know, it sounds like she was in a loving relationship for many years. It sounds like she grew up in a pretty nice part of the country. It sounds like she had like a nice home life. Given that there's no obvious like red flags except for the ones that where we can like speculate, like that's weird that her mother works for her. Outside of that, like honestly, there's no like huge massive like neon signs that say this is a victim story. And so given that that's the case, and given that she is so gleeful, given that if she is a 25-year-old woman who knows better and understands better, when you listen to her speak, she's very articulate. You can tell that she's very clever in how she's approached this subject, how she's approached her career. I think we should give her what she is asking for. And what she is asking for is full recognition of her intellect and her ability to judge for herself what is good for her, and that she's not a victim. And so I personally am happy to do that. But that comes with consequences as well. And the consequences is we won't excuse her predatory behavior. We won't ascribe it to that of somebody who doesn't know any better, or to somebody who's like being coerced into doing so. It kind of reminds me of sort of like Ghislaine Maxwell, of, you know, the partner to Jeffrey Epstein, who participated in the human trafficking of girls on his behalf and on behalf of like a wealthy group of friends that he procured girls and women for. It's kind of like all throughout she was able to absolve herself of her participation in the exploitation of other women, because basically she tried to play the victim role. But clearly when you look at like pictures of her with Jeffrey Epstein, when you consider her own individual power, because she came from a very wealthy family, when you also consider that she was with him for like a very long time, they met back in the 90s and they were still together at the time of his like death when he was like in prison. She clearly did this knowingly. She didn't do it under threat of violence. It wasn't a gun to her head. She did it because she too also gets off on the money that it brought, on the access it brought to powerful people, on the infamy it brought her, and also probably got off on the exploitation of women as well. So it's like, women should also be seen through the lens of being accountable for their predatory behavior across the board, whether it's like in the Ghislaine Maxwell case, where she is like also a sexual predator that abided Jeffrey Epstein's behavior, or also even in more like violent cases. Like one of the things you will notice often is that when women are accused of heinous violent crimes, and in particular when they're good looking, like the public finds it really difficult to believe that these women did what they did on purpose. A recent example is for example Lucy Letby, this monster of a woman who killed like multiple babies in the UK. And the only reason why the public like finds it very difficult to believe that she did so sanely, intentionally, with malintent or with bad intent, is because she's a woman and she's a good looking woman. You know, but otherwise, like literally the evidence is like is slam dunk. There is no ambiguity. Nobody else did it. There was no like male partner in the background coercing her into doing it. She did it because she's a bad person. Sometimes people think that dehumanization in terms of like women is like when people objectify women and they only view women through a sexual lens. But I honestly think that dehumanization is also when you rob people of the full spectrum of their humanity. The full spectrum of their humanity means that we all have good sides and we all have bad sides. Women aren't like these, like, caricature people who only have access to one side of their humanity. That side being the kind, nurturing, gentle, naive, victimized half. No, they also have another side. And that side includes having negative emotions and negative intentions, and also just being able to be manipulative, strategic, predatory, all things that I think apply in this case. Now, I'm not going to put like Bonnie Blue on any near the same level or in the same field at all as like Lucy Letby that I just spoke about. That was just like an example of somebody people like find difficult to believe did bad things. Or I'm not putting her in any same bracket or level as Ghislaine Maxwell. Like, clearly that woman is a monster, and I just don't think that they're comparative examples. However, I do think it demonstrates the limitations that sometimes people have in their perception of women and femaleness in general. And I think that that is like the main thing that I wanted to cover in this episode as far as Bonnie Blue is concerned, especially because I had already covered the Lily Phillips story, and I definitely covered that story from the perspective of like the victimization lens. I think it's also important to see the other side of the coin, in that sometimes women do things that are sexually exploitative to themselves, but also are sexually exploitative to other demographics of people, namely here like young boys. And it's important to recognize that so that we can see them through the proper lens and therefore hold them accountable to their actions. And so with that, I'm going to wrap up this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed the episode and were able to listen to the very end. If you did enjoy the episode, I'd really appreciate it if you left me a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts from. It just helps me be more findable when people search for relevant content or content related to this subject and other subjects that I cover. I'll be back next Monday as usual for a new episode. Until then, have a great week and speak to you then.